1945, U.S. Air Force is going to bomb Tokyo from Tinian Island. Muldrow, our protagonist, is a tail gunner in a B-29. A big guy and a little guy step to him. He defeats the big guy, takes the little guy under his wing. They take off in an airplane to Tokyo. Muldrow shoots down airplanes along the way. Their airplane gets shot down. He jumps out the door of the airplane with a parachute that he taped to the door. As he pulls a parachute, we cut back to Alaska. He's a teenager pulling a dog sled. The dog sled breaks. He kills one of the dogs and sticks his hands inside the dog to thaw his hands enough to fix the dog sled. When he gets home, his dad doesn't care at all. Flashback to Tokyo. He's hanging from a crane in the port of Tokyo from a parachute. He cuts the lines to swing side to side, gets on top of the crane, and witnesses the murder of an American Air Force guy just like him by a bunch of Japanese soldiers.
Woo!
Hell yeah.
I did it while looking at the sunset over Fulton Street in Lower Manhattan, out the window.
It's pretty orange. Not as orange as last week, but very beautiful.
I love that we stopped using sound blankets because now I can see out the window.
Yeah.
Has anyone been like, hey, I can really hear that you stopped using sound blankets?
This episode in the light is brought to you by Isotope RX Voice Denoise. Seriously, if you guys want to sponsor the show, love to talk. This week's transition was sent in by Lucas Kaiser, and it's Let's Go Fishing. This is To the White Sea, episode 14.
Pages 27 and 28.
At length, long after the airman has ceased to move, the blows stop. The men stand back. One of them steps up, gestures for another to join him. He grabs a heel. The other man grabs a heel. The party leaves, dragging the dead man with them, leaving a smear of blood. Their voices fade to silence. Muldrow advances toward his chute. Crane cab. Minutes later. Muldrow is climbing down towards the cab, his bundled chute hugged under one arm. Interior cab. Its bottom trap door is thrown open and Muldrow enters. He closes the trap door behind him. He looks around. The front window of the crane looks out at the projecting gantry. Though the interior of the cab is still dark, the gantry, pointing out to sea, seems to be aiming at a faint red glow to the east. The beginning of dawn. Muldrow jams his parachute behind the crane operator's chair. He sits down on the floor and empties his pockets, spreading the objects on the floor in front of him to take an inventory. He has his knife, a .45 pistol, two clips for the pistol, a small packet of fish hooks, a length of twine, a tin of sea rations with a top-opening key, two flints, a compass. The north on the compass is labeled with an ornately serifed N. Something that looks like a silk handkerchief, which he spreads to examine. On one side is a map of Japan, Tokyo labeled on the main island. His gaze shifts to one side. A small diamond inside a circle has corners that point the four directions. Only the top, however, N, has been labeled. His gaze drifts up the map, northward, along the length of the main island to the North Island where it lingers. Moving again, it travels up the northern archipelago of Japanese islands. A dotted line across the map indicates a break in scale. Above it is another archipelago, which the continuing upward pan reveals to be the Aleutians. Muldrow gazes. At length, he flips the handkerchief over. There is print on the other side. The top line is in English. Each line underneath is in a different transliterated foreign language, specified to the left. Annamese, Burmese, Thai, French, Japanese. Muldrow looks at the English original, at the top.
To the White Sea, to the White Sea. Of all the things I'd like to see, to the White Sea is the one I cannot.
Can't wait to read what's on the handkerchief.
You want to know what the top line in English is?
For sure.
And you feel like that's going to be revealed?
I'm sure it's going to be revealed. There's a colon. I like the description of all the different things that he has on him.
Definitely reminded me a lot of stuff in Castaway, where he's taking inventory of the objects that he has.
Yeah.
And then you see those objects get combined and break and form different tools later on, like throughout the course of the movie. You're always tracking the same objects. Life of Pi also has a lot of great kind of taking inventory. He talks about exactly the amount of stuff he has, and he has this rad little survival book that he uses and is journaling in. I think there's some stuff in The Martian, although I'm less familiar with that film, where he's like, I got this much of this stuff, and this isn't there. Yeah. Something very like bouncy from that movie where he's like, here's how bad it is. I got this much of this and this much of that.
It reminded me of scenes where someone got arrested and then they read off a list of all of their possessions.
It's the Blues Brothers, right?
Yeah.
Is that what we're thinking about? Is that the one? No, it's Austin Powers.
It's nice to get to know all the objects, but I feel like more pressing is the wrap-up of the scene of violence that we ended off last week's pages. We see the Japanese soldiers drag the man who's described as dead. So like it wasn't clear if he was dead or alive, but probably dead in last week's pages. Now the script makes that call, says he's dead as they drag him off. As their voices fade away, Muldrow wraps
he
it up.
Sneaks along.
He sneaks off.
He gets the audio cue. Their voices fade to silence. Safe to sneak around.
Distant dog barks. Not actually in the script, but
be a lot of stuff going on. And then the next thing you see is the crane, which you clearly saw. Like the geometry of this whole sequence is totally rad in terms of where the guards were, where the murder happened, where he was hiding, where he got stuck, where he had to crawl. And now like the smartest and closest place to hide is inside one of those little rooms that they have at the top of those tall. What do you call that? I've always wanted to go inside one of those rooms. I really like this part of the script because like
they called a cab.
It's called the cab.
That's what they call it here. Yeah.
I was kind of fantasized about those little boxy rooms that are like way up high that like the stevedores are inside of.
Yeah. I mean, it makes you imagine, it makes you feel like you're in a playset, right?
In like a treehouse.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of horrible stuff going on, but I feel like the second he gets inside, I can just imagine like the dimensions of that room are quite snug. I love the way they're describing the gantry pointing out to sea from the view inside the cab.
Yeah.
Just another thing that just totally connects the two spaces. And whereas the crane meant this one thing or made it, he almost looked like a puppet or like a guy hanging from a hangman's noose before. Now it's like a big kind of metal finger pointing forwards towards the red glow.
Yeah. It's like a compass. Like we have all this compass imagery and map imagery, and we have this giant, finger, yeah, this big pointing stick that's like pointing to the sun rising.
Like the reveal of him hanging on his parachute from the crane feels very iconic. You can really imagine the shapes of it, and the view out the window, you can really imagine the shape of it and how you can so clearly see the difference of like guy inside the cab is in a totally different position than guy hanging from a parachute on the crane attached to the cab.
And totally different from guy in flashback in a cabin staring at a fire.
Right. Yeah. He's moving through the chambers. It's almost like a very like action figure moves through like a video game landscape kind of movie. And he really is every couple pages. He's in a truly reversed situation and onto a new puzzle. And right now it's, I guess, making the inventory, right? He gets inside and starts to make the inventory.
Yeah. He's getting a sense of like what he has.
The thing that I do like about the inventory, the way they lay it out, is they really make it easy for you to imagine how the different things come together. Like it's like, here's a gun. Here's two clips for the gun. Here's some fish hooks. Here's some twine. And you're like, oh, the clips go in the gun. The fish hooks go with the twine. There's two flints. The two flints go together. Like it's just really easy to imagine all these objects that he's laying out. Being used in combination with each other to do basic survival stuff.
Yeah. Do you think, okay, so like moving on to this map that he has, I'm fascinated by this map. In fact, it's something that we're going to be talking about today. I love that it's described as being like a handkerchief. It feels like it's a reference to like politeness, polite society, like always bring a handkerchief, like a genteel 40s out on the town kind of vibe. But then I think about it more and I'm like, I think this is resembling a handkerchief because it's probably designed to not get ruined, right? Like if you printed this map on a piece of fabric or if it's sewn, like it's less likely to get messed up than a paper map.
I don't know why people stopped using handkerchiefs or what the... I mean, everyone's doing wild crap with like hand sanitizer and the energy morphed into a different zone, you know? But I bet it's a real object, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is definitely an object that would be on sale on that website where they have replicas of all the props from the Coens films. It would be it'd be on sale for about like $62.
Maps handkerchief selection for the very best. Vintage London map, silk handkerchief. British escape map, handkerchief. The silk maps were intended to assist airmen in evading capture. MI9 also smuggled silk and tissue paper escape maps into POW camps in Germany. So this is like a well-known article of like military paraphernalia. So that makes sense.
They were making silk maps. Not so much anymore.
I'd love to get my hands on one of these.
What would you like a silk map of?
White Plains.
Home Depot.
Yeah.
Like the layout of where everything is. I'm just trying to think about the most confusing spaces I find myself in.
IKEA. Yeah, no, Home Depot's good. That's where I get lost. Seriously. Can we talk about the Aleutians? The Aleutian Islands. They're an island chain in Alaska. So the Aleutian Islands were invaded during World War II by a small Japanese force. They occupied the islands of Attu and Kiska, where the remoteness of the islands and the challenges of weather and terrain delayed a larger American-Canadian force sent to eject them for nearly a year. Okay, here's Japan, and here are the Aleutian. Okay, so Japan is up here, and then the Aleutian Islands are over here.
I'm so confused.
So there's on the handkerchief, there's two island. There's pictures of two island chains. One of them is Japanese islands, and one of them is Alaskan islands.
Well, why would they have the Aleutian Islands if it's part of Alaska?
Because Japan invaded the Aleutians in 1942.
And so he has a handkerchief with a map of the Aleutian Islands. For what reason?
Maybe a bunch of people from Alaska were like, we got to defend our state. I mean, for me, I think the main thing that's important about it is that it's specific to his background.
The handkerchief keeps revealing secrets because at first you're like, oh, it's just a handkerchief. And then you're like, oh, it's a map. And then on the backside, it's like a dictionary.
Yeah. It's going to have some kind of like commonly used phrase or helpful phrase for the soldier or for the person who finds themselves in enemy territory to say in a bunch of different languages. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's like, I'm just curious if we're about to hear Muldrow like sound out a bunch of Japanese to try to identify himself. I guess my question and what I don't know and what I'm interested in is like, how much is he looking to this handkerchief as a guide for what to do next? And how much of is it like this sort of trivial item that he's not going to use? For me, I sort of, based on how it's written and how much detail the script goes into, I feel like this is important to him. I feel like it's something he's latching onto. Like it says Muldrow gazes, right? Like it feels like he's regarding this object with a fair amount of interest.
Yeah, I agree. He's soaking it up. They're really describing his gaze drifting along the map. You can imagine, you know, the inserts kind of panning and really guiding your eye. I am definitely really curious to know when he's going to eat those sea rations.
Yeah, I wonder. Do you think he's hungry?
I would want to stress eat.
Yeah, me too.
He's got the flints. He's going to use the flints together. He's got the compass. And then he's got the map. You know, they introduce the compass and then they introduce the handkerchief. And then the handkerchief is revealed to be a map. But it's definitely like this map plus this compass. You could actually use them together. And it'd be a little bit like having a phone.
Yeah. We also have the gantry showing us where.
Right. The gantry is like a huge compass, right?
Yeah, it
it's
is.
Like you're in.
The sun rises in the east.
Okay, so you can actually orient yourself in this scene and know which direction Muldrow, as he's looking at the map, like how the map lines up. Yeah, okay, so you can geolocate and orient this whole scene.
You can geoguess.
To due north.
Should we get oriented on the prism?
Yeah, please.
Let's jump into our our exciting catchphrase, split me up, beamy.
Split me up, beamy.
Split me up, beamy. It's the best thing we've ever come up with.
Enigmatic and totally resolved at the same time.
Split me up, beamy. Because the beam gets split by the prism. I just couldn't stop thinking about the map. I couldn't stop thinking about this item and this object and how much this character and how much I would be hanging on to anything that would give me my bearings after flipping and flying through the air, getting hung out to dry by my parachute. And I have these objects of survival. And then I have this, I have a compass and I have an artifact that gives me some direction for where I'm going to go next. And it gives me something to say too. It's like a script. So this week, I want to talk about scenes in Coen Brothers movies where characters have some kind of a guiding light. I think I'm going to call it guiding lights. Scenes in Coen Brothers works where characters latch onto some object or map or guidebook that will hopefully take them out of the situation they're in or change the situation they're in or help them make sense of the world. And sort of the question is like, will it or will it prove unreliable? Because that's kind of the question that I have in my mind when I read this scene is like, is that map going to help him or is he going to like, you know, like, is he going to be looking at the map and then like not look where he's going and like get spotted? I feel like I stretched my mind palates a little bit to try to come up with some things that are like not exactly one-to-one, but I think are like more about the emotional place that the character finds himself.
The big things you want to track today are where and what's happening to the character when this map or guiding light is introduced.
That's right.
What effect it has on them and like, does it guide or misguide them?
Yes.
Yeah.
I just wanted to talk about something that I think many people kind of can't stop thinking about. Like across the works of the Coens, there's like many enigmatic images. And I think one of the main ones is the bathing beauty, the print of the woman sunbathing in Barton Fink's hotel room. Hey, I just caught a mosquito.
No, it was just on your face, much like the poster of Barton Fink.
Yeah. Well, bye-bye, fucker. Hopefully I didn't kill somebody in the process. Everything in this hotel room is depressing. But he looks up at the wall. Oh, and he opens his typewriter, which is really important. You know, he opens the typewriter, he looks down on it, gets it ready to write. And then he looks up and sees a picture of a bathing beauty. A woman by the beach. You know, his complexion changes. Everything about his disposition changes as he gazes up at this. He looks at this image and he's transfixed by it. And you see it on his face. And then you see what he sees. And the camera kind of pushes in. Almost looks like it was optically printed. Like they went back in and adjusted the framing so that it was kind of perfect. And it zooms in so that the frame of the painting disappears. And there's a little bit of music and there's sound design of the beach. So he's transported mentally, emotionally. And then for the rest of the film, this guiding light, when he wants to center himself, it becomes an object of fascination for him. And we talked about this before. The thing that's interesting about the movie is that, at least according to like what we see on screen, Barton does not die. He doesn't get arrested. We see him at the end of the film with a box that we don't know what's in it, walking down the beach. He meets a beautiful woman. He becomes transfixed by a woman who looks remarkably like the photo, almost an exact match. We end the film with him gazing out at this woman who looks exactly like the bathing beauty who he's had on his hotel room wall. He's lost in a real life version of that image.
You think they shot this last scene first and then made the prop based off of the footage they got back?
It's a very good question. I would love to ask someone who was on the shoot.
I feel like that last little bit where the seagull dive bombs directly in the center of the frame is kind of delightful because they're paying off this visual thing that they've set up and they match it perfectly. And so you know the shot is super, super controlled. And then this thing that, you know, they didn't train the seagull to do it just like that. You know, they caught that and they were like, Jesus Christ, that's perfect.
Yeah.
And I just love it because, you know, the film is so precise and so kind of just elegantly constructed. And there's something about the last thing being like a perfect bullseye, almost just like the thing goes right in, complete, perfect, go to black. It's just, it just feels like a, almost like a punctuation, like it's the period at the end of the movie. It's just like crisp and good.
And it feels real.
It's clearly a wild caught thing. It's like a lucky shot, like Emily said.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, like, for me, it complexifies the meaning. It complicates the meaning of what that final shot is.
Okay, well, I think this scene is genuinely designed to be truly read multiple ways because there's no pull out. There's no, like, here's what's really going on kind of reveal at the end of it, which I could totally imagine, especially because the film Brazil, at least to me, ends in such a similar way where it's like there's the soaring music, there's the theme, and then it cuts out and he's been tortured and he's like humming the theme song of the movie. So you can tell that like it's his fantasy that he's inside of, but like you can, like the sound makes it match, right?
Yeah.
And it's very clear, like rip back the curtain, this is really what's going on, you know? So in this one, it leaves you more in the moment where, you know, he's on the beach and at the moment that she like perfectly matches up with the pose and the image just is exactly what we've been seeing the entire film. To me, that's the moment where I'm like, oh, Barton's still in his room. Like he's in his room and he's looking at the picture on his wall so hard that he's sucked inside of it for a second.
Yeah.
Like he's lost his sense of place.
Which begs the question, like, what happened to did the hotel hallway not really burn down? Like, there's all this other trailing stuff, like leading stuff that, you know, if he's in his hotel room at the end of the movie, like, what else wasn't real? Or what else isn't real if that's not real?
Yeah, and I think the two ways you can read it, like, he's clearly mentally ill at the end of the film, right?
Yeah.
And it's either that he's on the beach, and it's one of those experiences where you just haven't slept, and you've been this, like, extremely cerebral person and you're dirty and all of a sudden you're out in the daylight and you're just like, you're not really seeing things accurately. You're kind of like, there's too much light and you're bringing everything that's in your head from the last like 5 days. And so it's like, maybe he's been staring at this picture so much that he's like printing it on things.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's one kind of hallucination. That's like, it's like Captain Haddock looking at Tintin. He sees like a whiskey bottle. It's like that kind of thing where it's just like, yeah, this is what's in your mind. Or it's like, but to me, I think he's in his room. I really do.
Could I offer an alternate version, which is that he's sitting on the beach holding the photo up to the horizon. Like he's out of the hotel room and he's holding it up.
He's ripped it off the wall.
Yeah.
And now he's brought it to a place and she's not there. He's just holding it like in the spot to complete the image.
Yeah, something like that, maybe. But I think that's like what's awesome about not having the like Brazil style ending is that even if you are committed to the interpretation that he's not really there, he's not really seeing this, what's actually happening is completely up to your interpretation.
Yeah, because it's when he looks at the picture the first time, the sound cue starts up and starts to zoom in, and it really has one of those like, I forget which, like Chris Van Allberg, is it like Jumanji or something, where it's like the paintings become windows kind of thing, you know, and the weather starts to come through them. It's like, you can really see him getting sucked inside just from the way that they show it having a kind of magnetic pull and the sound kind of emanating from it. Like it's a portal. I think the reason why he orients and gravitates towards this picture is pretty laid out by the fact that the window faces a wall. It's not really a view. And so when he sits down, it's like, it's one of those things where this becomes the view,
yeah.
You know, this becomes the living, you know, he's starting to feed off of artificial stuff more than off of the real world. Cause he's actually in a box that he can't see out of. And so he starts to gravitate towards this artificial representation of a sky and the ocean and a woman. He's lonely. You know, it's like, she's very much like, that image doesn't just represent like, it just represents leisure and safety and like kind of the idea of success at that time.
Yeah. But where he finds himself, he doesn't have a view.
No, because the reality is you just like like in a little shoebox.
Yeah. So instead, he has a window basically into his imagination, into an imagined elsewhere.
At that moment, you see him start to veer away, like because he's put himself in this hotel. He's now in a place where he can't see out. And so now he's going to start to gravitate. This is going to be his North Star. And over time, it's going to eat away at him until by the end, he's like, either if he's actually there and he's projecting this on the real world, or he's just still in the room and can't tell that he's not inside the picture. It's a sickly feedback loop that he's in.
Yeah.
Poor mental health.
Yeah.
Poor mental health habits.
It's tough. It's tough for Barton. So just to answer the question, does this guiding light guide him, or does it misguide him? Like for me, I see it as something that at least calms him down at certain moments. And it's better than, it's better than nothing maybe, but it's not real. It's not reality. I would put it in the category of false hope, or not a particularly accurate map that's going to like guide him towards like figuring out how to write a good screenplay, figuring out how to write relatable characters, figuring out how to treat Audrey properly.
You go see a bird in a zoo, and they have a painting of a sunset on the wall behind them. There's nothing more depressing. It's like truly the most depressing thing in the world. And so he's stuck. It adds up.
Yeah. Ooh. One of the more enigmatic images, but I think we got to some truth. Some truth that Barton never really gets. You know, he at the end of the film, he doesn't know what's in the box. He doesn't know if he killed Audrey. And he's basically lost his grip on reality.
Do you want to shout out too that you pointed out that the angle of the hallways and the angle of the shore on the beach, like when he's inside the hotel and when they're walking on the beach, it's like such a match that it calls attention to itself.
Yeah.
So which like, I think is another, can you just say, I feel like that might be another tip off that like maybe we're still in the hotel.
Totally. Yeah. The beach, the line of the shore and the line of like the baseboard of the hallway.
Yeah.
Like really are really matching if you watch the two scenes, like where this painting is introduced and where he meets the woman on the beach at the end.
You've seen the image of him shuffling in his suit down that hallway at that angle so many times throughout the course of the film, but by the last time you see him just like same shuffle but just in a different location, you're really like, I get it. Like that's the orientation.
Yeah, and you don't go to the beach in a full suit. Like I think even Barton Fink would like put on a pair of shorts. Like he feels superimposed onto that setting when you see him in that costume. Like all of his, everything that he's wearing, he's still like brown and green and like dark, like dingy, desolate color palette.
He's been copied and pasted from one reality and dropped into the reality of the painting. Like in the Akira Kurosawa's Dreams. Remember those loopy sequences from this movie?
You've shown me clips. I know you love this movie.
There's a sequence where Martin Scorsese plays Vincent Van Gogh and this other guy's walking around inside Van Gogh's paintings, and it is wild stuff. Really encourage you to check that out. The listener, I mean.
Well, I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll come back to you. I'll watch it. We'll watch and we'll talk about it next week. Next guiding light. Next scene.
Also, is this a reference to the Television song? Guiding Light by Television?
It is not.
You want to pull that up just real quick? We'll just get a little taste of it.
Let's listen to it, yeah. Well, I think we know what the end of the episode's going to be.
He sings a little bit like Patti Smith and a little bit like the guy from the Violent Femmes. One's ever asked for my like top lowest hanging fruit Television take. And I'm like, sounds a little bit like Patti Smith and a little bit like Gordon Gano. Yeah. Gano? Gordon Gano.
So the Coen brothers participated in two omnibus films after directing Lady Killers.
Fresh off the triumph of Lady Killers, universal acclaim. Did Lady Killers make money?
It's a good question.
Was it just that cool people stopped like, because it was like Intolerable Cruelty was like mass hit. But yeah. Cool people were like.
Lady Killers made $77 million on a budget of 35. Pretty reasonable. Didn't take a bath on that one. Moderate.
But what's like, is it like Rotten Tomatoes? Is like nightmarish? What's the...
Lady Killers was a 54% on the tomato meter. So okay. Got to be their worst reviewed film.
Gotta watch that tomato meter.
Yeah. You gotta, you don't want to get hit by a rotten tomato. You want to get hit by a fresh tomato. You know, you want to get hit right in the face by a tomato, but it better be a fresh. Can't be a rotten tomato. Anyways, we find the Coen brothers perhaps looking for a guiding light of their own in short subjects.
So you think they're lost and their new compass is making shorts for omnibus films?
Maybe they wanted to try some things out. So Paris Jatem is an omnibus film, and they made a short for it called Tuileries. Tuileries. You want to try it?
Trillery.
Trillery, yeah. It's trilling, folks. This is a trilling twiller of a short film starring Steve Buscemi as an American tourist at the train station right near the Louvre. And he's got a bag full of souvenirs.
He went to the gift shop.
He went to the gift shop, for sure. Where'd he get? He got
lots of very surface-level seeming, mostly stuff of the Mona Lisa, right?
Yeah, dozens of pictures of the Mona Lisa.
Because they have other cool stuff there. It looks like he has gotten gifts to bring home to basically everyone who's like, what was Paris like?
And he's looking at his guidebook. And this guidebook is a magic guidebook because everything that it says happens right in front of him. And that's the joke or the gag of this short. So that's his guiding light. A description of French society from the perspective of a tourist guidebook.
This is super similar to the White Sea pages because there's like literal translation, like useful phrases section.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the part that jumps out to me the most.
For sure. Yeah. Although, so basically he gets threatened by like a French man the French man thinks Steve Buscemi was like basically ogling him and
he broke the rule. He made eye contact.
He made eye contact, which is against the rule.
Yeah.
And if you listen to the episode Sneakers last week, if you're sneaking around, you're trying not to be noticed, don't make eye contact. Number one rule.
He didn't even realize he was being sneaky.
But he was. Everybody on that train platform is very French and they're judging the hell out of him. And as soon as he reads the rule, no eye contact, he makes eye contact. And the guy starts yelling at him some random stuff that he doesn't know. But fortunately, he's got his guidebook. Scrolls down. It says, you bleep, you C word. I'm just very interested in the fact that they wrote this scene into the White Sea. And then like kind of similar to how later they gave Brad Pitt like a comic sneak around. They kind of wrote a vaguely similar situation for like a random bozo who found himself in France.
Yeah, like Barton, he's an out-of-towner. He's latching in. He doesn't know where he is. He latches into this book the way that Barton latches into the picture. And by the end of it, he's lost everything.
He's also similarly enraptured by the Mona Lisa's ambiguous smile. To put a fine point on it, like the thing about the venereal diseases, like even references like servicemen abroad, the guidebook is not subtle.
Okay, so the things that the guidebook says to him, right? It's like lovers of love, Mona Lisa, this is where you are. The first three pages that are inserts are just making him feel calm and safe. And like everything that's going on around him is like that he's in like the pocket of just like culture and people that love good vibes. And then scoot, 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 camera like pans across the page. Eye contact is a big problem. And then he makes eye contact, right?
Yeah.
And then this guy starts yelling at him. He looks back at the book, and the book where it was previously like, hey, everything's good, feel safe. The book tells him like, this is exactly how foul this guy is calling you out. You know, I feel like at that point, it's like the book is cursing at him, right? There's like my favorite part of this short is the two shots where he looks for some kind of friendship or some kind of like empathy from the other people on the platform. He looks at the musician, very stony, and he looks at like the toughest looking bald guy in a suit, like out of an action movie, like a goon from an action movie.
Some kind of weird henchman type figure.
Just two, in their own way, two of the least empathetic and also not the most obvious stock type, like Parisian people, but definitely like feels like observed from reality.
Yeah.
I don't know. And then the next thing he sees is like, is all about the syphilis, right?
Yeah. He doesn't want to contract a social disease.
A social disease.
The guy's girlfriend shows up on the platform next to him and gives him a big smooch. And he's into it for a second. Then he sees she has a She has a sore, or he thinks he sees something on her lip.
And then it goes away.
It was just his imagination.
I think so.
The guiding light fucked over Steve Buscemi. Not a high quality guiding light.
The book made him feel too safe and told him about danger at the last second, and then just kind of piled on.
Until the Mona Lisa was smiling at him in a way that he didn't like. Misguided by his North Star. He thought he was looking at the North Star. He was looking at the South Star, folks.
The last shot of it is literally just the Mona Lisa's face.
It's like a slow zoom in on the Mona Lisa's face.
It's very similar to Barton Fink. Guy has been destroyed, ends up looking at a painting.
That's right. Maybe it should have ended with him in a real life situation where he's seeing the actual Mona Lisa.
Yeah.
And he thinks he's Da Vinci. That would be interesting, like in a movie about Da Vinci's life, to just see like who, like the woman he was looking at, like in like a background, you know? It would be trippy.
You want to see a movie about Da Vinci painting the Mona Lisa?
Yeah.
Sounds very marketable.
Yeah.
But a lot of people would see that fucking movie.
It's called Who Is She?
Who is she?
Yeah. Yeah.
You didn't see that Ewan McGregor film that was like a sequel to The Shining? What was that thing called?
Oh, Mr. Sleep.
You didn't see Mr. Sleep?
Dr. Sleep.
Dr. Sleep. Mr. Sleep.
It's like how Mr. Death is like the Kevorkian movie and not Dr. Death.
I remember Dr. Death.
Yeah.
Yeah, the doctor is out of his mind. No, I'm thinking of Dr. Giggles. Sorry. Remember Dr. Giggles?
Yeah, that one, that scared me.
Right.
Yeah.
We're the only people. No one that was 6 months older than us was afraid of Dr. Giggles.
Yeah.
And no one who is 6 months under us could understand what Dr. Giggles was. We were in the pocket. I remember my dad was working for a bunch of people who had just, the last film they had made was Dr. Giggles. My dad was always like, well, these people make fucking Dr. Giggles. So what do they know about the choices I'm making?
Who are they to judge?
Exactly.
Poor Steve Buscemi. That's the end. That's all I have to say. Poor,
like,
Steve,
why does he never come out on top in one of their movies?
I guess he's not very, I guess it doesn't work out well for him.
Well, these are all pretty good movies.
They're both excellent.
All right, what's this to Le Règle du Jeu?
That may be Jean Renoir's greatest film. It's a group of people interacting in a big house in the country in France. It's Renoir's masterpiece. It's sort of a human comedy of sorts on a grand tapestry.
Well, you're pretty high on that one, aren't you?
Yes. Pristine new print.
Oh, isn't that? Well, what's this one, Climates?
Turkish film. It's Nuri Bilge Ceylan's second film.
Uh-huh. What's that one about?
It's about lovers and estrangement, former lovers, flawed people, and the difficulty of love and so forth.
Hmm. So they'd be talking back and forth in Turkish?
In Turkic.
Turkic? Hmm. All right, but you got the words up there to help follow the story along?
It's subtitled, yes.
Whew. All right. Hmm. They're nudity?
Partial?
Mm-hmm.
I like this short a lot. A short film called World Cinema, part of an omnibus film called...
To Each His Own Cinema?
To Each His Own Cinema. It's about a similarly confused man in a place that he doesn't seem like he understands why he's there, what he's going to do. And he is played by Josh Brolin. Josh Brolin, who plays kind of a stock cowboy type, who finds himself in an art theater in Los Angeles. Can you tell me about this theater, Ray? And then could you tell me about the guy he meets in there?
The theater is The Arrow. It's in Santa Monica. It's a rep theater. It's rad. I've gone to some rad screenings there with rad Q&As after. And the guy who's working at the theater is Grant Heslov, who, to me, I first clocked in True Lies, right? He's a part of like Schwarzenegger's team in True Lies. And then I think over the course of his career, really, he's one of George Clooney's best friends, like forever. And they started Smokehouse Production Company together, right? That's what their shingle is called. And all that stuff in the aughts where they were making just movie after movie where they caught that wave. Heslov is a huge part of like all that Clooney creative output, the kind of writing creative part of it.
Yeah, well, the writing part's a big part of it because he wrote Good Night and Good Luck. And then he and George Clooney rewrote a Coen Brothers movie for Suburbicon, which I have not seen.
He did Punch Up on Suburbicon?
He's a writer on it. It's him and Clooney and the Coens.
Who did what when?
It was kind of a long story, but...
I felt like with Suburbicon is...
I just think it's interesting that they have an actor in their movie who would then, like, who's like Clooney's boy, and then he would end up writing on a script that originated with them for a movie in 2015. But here in 2007, he's trying to give advice to Josh Brolin, who seems very lost, and he's trying to find his guiding light on the marquee outside and on the like little schedule of showtimes at the movie theater. And he's looking and he's trying to decide between two movies. Those movies are Jean Renoir's Rules of the Game and Nori Bilge Ceylon's Climates, which I watched today and is a beautiful film. He's looking at these showtimes and he's trying to figure out, where am I going next? What am I going to see? And he's asking Grant Heslov, who works at the movie theater, for advice and kind of connects with him. You would imagine that the guy would just be like, I'll go to the multiplex. But no, he buys a ticket for Climates and has a very moving experience with it and kind of reaches somewhere that he comes out of the movie. He's got his hat off and he's walking out of the movie theater and he looks very moved by the film that he just saw.
This is the character from No Country for Old Men, right? He's playing the same guy. He's playing Llewellyn.
So do you think this was like almost a screen test?
Well, I just want to know which one came out first. Which one did they shoot first?
I guess the obvious thing would be that he spent months as this character and then they shot this as a little capper.
Yeah, he's fucking around.
Just fucking around.
Yeah, and just taking the guy and putting him in the opposite. What is the opposite of No Country for Old Men? It's seeing a movie in Santa Monica.
Yeah, but I'm very touched by this short subject. I've always, like, when you first sent it to me, I was like, this is a lost Coen's film for me, because I think it's really tender, and I also think the choices of the two movies that they picked feel dead on in terms of like contemporary screenings. Like it reminds me of like the way that like Tarantino shoots like the mall in Jackie Brown. In a way that, like, I don't think he would, like, do, like, a present-day movie nowadays. Like, it reminds me also of, like, Magnolia, too. Like, it's, like, filmmakers of a certain ilk being, like, I'm just going to actually just, like, show what Los Angeles is like right now. And kind of shout out this beautiful, small, but also devastating Turkish film about a guy who's cannot keep a relationship together. And I certainly felt like Josh Brolin after I watched it today. Like, I was, like, kind of, like, very moved and very torn up by the way the character was behaving. Because he's not a good guy. Like Grant Heslov says, flawed people, flawed characters.
It's a hell of a lot of truth.
It's a hell of a lot of truth in Climates.
What's the number one?
It's the tiny, minute details of how a character can, how one guy can kind of dash somebody's hopes for like the future of a relationship by like just saying one thing and then her realizing, you know, they're not going to get back together. And when you see it, the whole movie kind of comes into focus. Yeah, it's just about characters like being really extreme. Even though it's like super slice of life, super like just like one paper lantern lit scenes, like very, very spare, but also like the shots that it chooses to kind of extend super long. Like in a lot of ways, it's just like a movie that it's the epitome of like that type of like art film. But when you're actually watching it, you're like, wow, this is insanely devastatingly effective. And like, I'm so moved by these characters and like, you know, the empathy that I have for them because of how like kind of unempathetic some of the characters are for each other. So yeah, highly recommend Climates. It was my guiding light, right? Like it's almost like that's like kind of like the, I don't know, maybe that's like the trick of this. It's like it's a 3-minute film that the Coens made so that you'll watch this like hour and 40-minute Turkish film, or you'll go watch Rules of the Game, which is like another one of my favorite movies.
We talked about, like, does Josh Brolin ever have a kind of like I'm breaking down losing it scene in No Country for Old Men? And he doesn't really. He just gets physically hurt. In this scene, you see the character actually kind of go through something where he's been rocked, you know?
It's deeply awkward.
But also, you're just talking about, he has his hat off and he's, you know, just that look that he has. He's been rocked by a good movie at the Arrow, a solid rep screening.
That's right.
Yeah. And what I like about the, you know, you said when we were watching it, the last shot is he leaves the Arrow. He looks to the left. He looks to the right. Or maybe it's the other way. But anyway, he looks in both directions and then makes a decision to go in one way or the other. And the, you know, the film opens with the guys looking at the marquee and it's like, I have two choices of film going experiences that I'm going to have. And one is like, what it basically boils down to is like old black and white European classic movie and very, very new, very, very foreign film. And just a guy from Texas, you know, trying to figure out, you take the red pill or the blue pill in terms of like, what is like for someone that just like watches sports and like watches like stuff like, maybe like rodeo stuff. Like he's looking to see some livestock.
Yeah, he asks if there's nudity, is there livestock?
Yeah, he wants nudity and livestock, you know? Yeah. That's what he's looking for. It's like, what is better? Like a digital film in Turkic or what sounds like, I mean, how
a
long,
black and white print of like long? A French language movie. And what you are presupposing is that if he had seen the other movie, he would have gone left instead of right.
No, I'm just saying it's like the whole.
Cause that's how I see the ending.
No, I guess you can figure out, you can look at a map and be like, is he going towards the ocean or is he going inland? It's another mappable scene. It's a very, very cozy and recognizable space. And this is really like, I'm sure, a theater where they spent a good deal of time. And it looks exactly like that. It's not dressed. They're just taking a character from one of their other movies and plopping him in. It's like taking a character from Dick Tracy and making them go to Anthology or something.
Like in one of those Dick Tracy specials, they would probably do that.
Yeah, exactly.
And it feels kind of like one of those Dick Tracy. I mean, I think it's really fun to see that with these shorts. I think it's really fun to see the Coens working, and especially with this one, like working in almost a Dogma 95 style with like two talented actors, one of whom is going to like sort of about to be the main centerpiece of like their best picture winning movie. Right. But they shot this on like HD, like, you know, it just doesn't, it's not, like you said, it's not dressed.
I think both the train station from Steve Buscemi short and this are like basically probably what they look like in real life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Buscemi one looks a little bit more lit. Like it looks a little bit higher gloss.
Oh, yeah. It's got that Bruno look.
Yeah.
That's their first Bruno collaboration.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, that changed. So that's interesting. But this one doesn't even have a cinematographer credit. It just says camera.
I'm looking at Grant Heslov's IMDb here. Grant Heslov is the executive producer on Ticket to Paradise, Money Monster, The Men Who Stare at Goats, co-producer on Intolerable Cruelty, and has directed, as far back as I can see, every single George Clooney Nespresso commercial.
Sure, it's paid for a few Nespresso machines. I love Grant Heslov's performance in this. I really love the way he describes the films. I don't think he condescends to the guy at all. He tells him exactly what he thinks.
He's an amazing character actor forever. Yeah, he was on Happy Days.
Yeah. But he's so genuine with him. So I just like, yeah. So like, I want to say like, Barton Fink looked to that painting. It was Schmaltz. Steve Buscemi, he looked to his like little Louvre paraphernalia. You know, I'm not going to like, do the hack thing and say the Mona Lisa is a bad painting. But I think
Think it's a bad painting?
I don't have a strong opinion. I think it's a cool painting for sure. I think it's cool.
He's in the Birdcage too. Do you remember? Yeah. He's like one of the photographers trying to get a picture of them.
Yeah.
Sorry.
The original La Cage aux Folles? No, crazy Chivo photography in the Birdcage, by the way. Check it out again, just on a cinematography angle. Crazy, crazy opening shot. Like starts as a helicopter shot and then it goes inside. You seen this? The opening of the Birdcage?
I have. I know exactly what you're talking about. Cool camera moves.
Yeah. Thank you for not saying you've seen this. You heard about this. Appreciate it.
Everyone said it. I don't need to say it anymore.
Anyway, I just wanted to say this is an example of you feel lost. You feel extreme loneliness. You feel like Barton Fink. You're in a new city. You're in Los Angeles, just like Barton Fink. And You go to the movies and you can't go wrong.
I feel like in this situation, he's got a friend to help him translate the map.
Yeah.
He's not just a guy with a handkerchief or a little guidebook and a bunch of, it's like, you know, Steve Buscemi looks to the musician. He looks to the ball guy and says like, hey, will you help me figure this out? And they will not help him. He doesn't have a French Grant Heslov.
No.
To help him kind of walk it through and kind of ask questions that might be embarrassing and not judge him.
Right. And that makes all the difference. Why do you think he chooses climates? It feels like it's really a coin flip for him. It just seems like he just makes it like, I'll get one for climates. Yeah, let's do it. I don't know.
Oh, it's a more, the pitch that he gives for climates is more primal.
Mm.
Like all he says about the Rig de Joux is like that it's great. It's kind of human comedy on a grand tapestry. Yeah. It's like, it's just not the...
He says it's his masterpiece.
Yeah, it's like, it's very much like, this isn't, it's more like, this is film history. Whereas this other one's like, this is kind of raw movie.
This is what's going on.
Yeah, you might want to check this out.
Yeah. Yeah, he chose right. So score one for going to the Arrow if you feel like you don't know what to do with yourself.
He wanted nudity in livestock, and he was like, well, there's a rabbit in one, and there's partial nudity in the other. And I think he chose the partial nudity over the rabbit. He certainly did.
Good guidance in this short.
It's very funny and very cool to make a, especially with a film that's so like austere and so kind of... treated with such seriousness as No Country for Old Men, to take that character and drop him in a movie this silly and this short and this kind of tender, I think is a really cool... When I posted a clip of this on Instagram, I really did... A bunch of people responded like they were hallucinating, because it's just... You would never think that they would take like a literal playing piece out of one film and drop it in another and be so loose with it. But they're... Even with their most serious masterpiece, right? It's like, it's just kind of a toy, or it's just like a collaboration between them and Brolin, and you know he's silly. It definitely is a little bit akin to the Dick Tracy, like for legal reasons, or it's just like,
for legal reasons, we need to make this short
a character
film.
Out of time in a less than feature film.
Yeah, that's probably why they did it. They wanted to hold on to the Llewellyn character rights for like an extra 2 years, and if they did this digital content, it just like it changed the game contractually.
Yeah,
I understand the physics. I understand the dead cat, but you can't really understand the physics without understanding the math. The math tells how it really works. That's the real thing. The stories I give you in class are just illustrative. They're like fables, say, to help give you a picture. I mean, even I don't understand the dead cat. The math is how it really works.
Very difficult.
Let's wrap things up with our final film of a character trying to find order and sense in a world that makes no sense to him, or that is making increasingly less sense. We're talking about a serious man, and we're talking about Larry Gopnik's chalkboard drawings, his relationship to, I guess, physics and mathematics. I wanted to talk about how crazy the chalkboard stuff is in this movie and how it provides this character at first with like a lot of joy and a lot of like kind of comfort when he's showing the class Schrodinger's cat and explaining the math behind Schrodinger's cat about how you never know if the cat is alive or dead. And so therefore, like, nobody knows what's going on. And he seems very comfortable in telling the class that nobody knows what's going on. When we meet Larry early on in the film, he's not a man of God. His guiding light is mathematics, it's physics, and it's teaching. His brother, Arthur, has his own version of mathematics that he's working on, the Mentaculus, which is a probability map of the universe. You know, Larry has his explanation of things, the rabbis have their explanation of things, and then his brother has a seemingly schizophrenic nonsense book, but then we find out that it can help him win at card games. It actually works. Final scene that I wanted to sort of put a capper on is his dream sequence, where we see basically a reinterpretation of the classroom scene, but the classroom is like a gigantic hundreds of seat classroom. This like Colosseum like chalkboard is completely covered with insane mathematical theories. It's his theory of everything, and it has like Hebrew characters on it and resembles like a synthesis of his map of the universe and his brother's map of the universe. And he sees Cy Abelman, and Cy Abelman says, yes, it's compelling, it's clever, but is it convincing? And he basically says to him, like, you need to see Marshak. I fucked your wife. And then he starts like smashing him into the chalkboard. It's a dream about this dead man coming back to life to knock him out of his worldview.
So there's the Mentaculus, right? And there's the writing on Larry's chalkboard at the beginning. And there's the writing on Larry's imagined chalkboard at the end. And there's like a real kind of spectrum of like, the imaginary chalkboard is enormous, but it's like kind of a combination of stuff that makes sense and stuff that looks more delirious. Whereas the Mentaculus is like, I don't know, the balance is like, this is like 80% magical. And then there's some like symbols that are recognizable from math.
And Hebrew, too.
And Hebrew mixed together, right?
Yeah.
One brother is a ne'er-do-well and the other has his head on straight, right? But they both spend their time like in these symbols, like really, really in these symbols that other people don't understand. Like his job is to explain to students what all this crap means.
Yeah.
And there's a story at the beginning. There's the fable that starts the film.
Yeah.
And so when he's with Clive, you know, we just saw him talking about Schrodinger's cat in class. And he goes, the stories I give you in class are just illustrative. They're like fables to help give you a picture, an imperfect model. The film gave you this fable at the beginning, and now it's introducing you to this physicist, physics teacher.
Yeah.
Okay. Now it's introducing you to this physics teacher who's telling you physics is what's underneath the fable, and underneath the physics is math, and math is just really crisp.
Yeah. That's reality.
Yeah.
And what his dream is telling him is that's bullshit.
I think what's scary about his brother is that he's so much like him, but just those like really, really important degrees off, where you go from being someone who's accepted by society to someone who's actually like, it's illegal to just be yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because society has use for Larry. Like he can teach kids like how to maybe split an atom or something.
Well, what is he teaching the kids? Like what's his big...
He's teaching them quantum physics. Like he's teaching them about the collapsing of a... Of randomness into like, you know, like the probabilistic model of physics, like where like a choice is made and like this like field of probability like collapses into like a definite discrete outcome. Or like some people would say like the universe splits at that moment.
Actions have consequences often.
Often.
The funniest lines like yeah. in the history of movies.
Yeah.
So actions have consequences because it's yes, often. The weird thing is Larry does a lot more teaching. Like you don't actually see him teach that much on screen in the like objective reality, but he actually goes on a longer lecture in the dream. Yeah, he says to the kids, but I think he's really, you know, it's like this is the big, like as they're leaving the room, he says to all the students, like the uncertainty principle, it proves we can't ever really know what's going on. Although you will be responsible, you know, like
yeah, I think on the midterm,
it proves we can't ever really know what's going on. So it shouldn't bother you not being able to figure anything out. Although you will be responsible for this on the midterm. I think that that's like the dual thing of like, yeah, like the reality of everything that I'm trying to teach you is that it's completely impossible to know what's going on. But that is going to have huge consequences. That doesn't let you off the hook at
right.
all. You're still responsible for the choices you make and the causality of those choices in a world that is like the one thing I'm trying to teach you is it's impossible.
It's impossible to know.
It's impossible to even figure anything out. Not even just to know, just to like get a little part of it figured out.
Kind of like the ambiguity of Mona Lisa's smile or the lady on the beach, whether she's real or not.
Well, the Coens are good at making stuff that actually functions the way that people talk about a Mona Lisa smile, where it's like, I don't know. Like, is it like it's the Mona Lisa smile is like the ending of Barton Fink, where you're like,
or the ending of Serious Man.
When the tornado hits them?
Yeah, or his cancer or whatever he's going to find out about at the doctor.
I don't see a real second meaning to the end of Serious Man, but can you tell me what you see as it?
Well, like, you don't know if the kid's going to die.
You really don't know what's going to happen at all.
No, you don't. And you don't know. I mean, he could go through it. Period of terrible illness, but he could, you know, he's condemned at the end of the film. He's condemned by his actions, splitting of an atom kind of way.
You leave him in the moment where he knows he has to go to the doctor to get a diagnosis, but he doesn't know what it's going to be. So it's like you cut out and then he's stuck there in the audience's mind forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because moments like that do.
It's the C-, though. I mean, like, I think the interesting thing is, like, okay, so, like, Arthur's Mentaculous allows him to, like, get one over on the Gentiles card game, right? Like, he has this.
It seems crazy, but it works. It has results.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. It has tangible
something
results.
He's doing is like more connected to what Larry's doing than it looks like from his general Richard kindness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
His Richard kindness. He's killing him with kindness. When Larry decides to give him the C and then the C minus, and we talked about this in episode 9, in a way he accesses that same power as Arthur. He you know, within the logic of the film, he puts that C minus. Phone rings immediately. He's condemned. He's condemned himself because of his, like, I don't know, because of his faith in like math and physics and grades, and because he took the money to pay for Arthur's legal bills.
It's like, do the actions have consequences? Like, yes, often. I feel like that's an ambiguous thing about the end of the film. It's like, is it just in his head that the fact that he did that is why he got in trouble? Like, is he in this point where he's drawing lines between things? Yeah. Causality that is like not there, because there's this whole feeling of that there's this like fate descending upon him throughout the film, and then all of a sudden like all these things kind of get wrapped up and resolved and he's kind of back home safe, and then this last kind of temptation is kind of brought in front of him, and it's understandable at that point. He's like, well, what's so bad about taking this money? All the danger seemed like it kind of passed, you know?
Yeah, nobody knows about it.
Yeah,
it's an envelope full of cash.
And maybe actions, like Clive said, actions, you know, sometimes actions don't have consequences.
Yeah.
Sometimes things just don't mean anything.
Yeah. Clive's dad tells him to accept the mystery.
Arthur is trying to just like navigate his way to the core of reality, like in a way that a human being has never experienced before.
Yeah.
And I think Larry is trying to convey to the students that like underneath the fables and underneath the physics, there's this math thing that shows you that like you can never really, really know, but you will be responsible for that. And that's like,
you will be graded on this.
Maybe that's the thing that he would only say out loud in his dreams, but maybe that's the thing that's like kind of gnawing at him.
Yeah.
So he's like smart enough to understand that it doesn't add up, but that like, as he's living through it in real time, he knows like the fact that I don't understand what's causal and what's totally arbitrary is having gigantic consequences in whether I'm safe or happy.
Yeah. Sai comes through and says,
Go to the rabbi.
He says, go to the rabbi. He also says, it's not convincing. And he says, mathematics is the art of the possible, which is wrong. But Henry Kissinger said, diplomacy is the art of the possible. He's feeding him an alternate hypothesis in some weird dream logic way.
I feel like he's saying, just go back to the fable. You know, just go back to the thing that has nothing, like, just go back to the ancient thing. Go talk to Marcia. I was just saying, like, is that not what's going on?
I think that's mostly what's going on. But here's one wrinkle, which is that in the script, he was supposed to be wearing like a prayer shawl. Like he was supposed to represent like ancient Hebrew tradition and wisdom. But in the movie, they put him in the golf clothes. So for me, like, I feel like that choice was like not wanting to put like too fine a point on it and having him more represent like.
It's like a double point.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like it's maybe it was arbitrary, or they saw him in that costume and they're like, this costume just looks so great on him. We want, because it is wonderful how you can like see his whole body, even though he's got the little table. And
yeah.
and the, you know, they always talk about like costumes turning actors into shapes.
Yeah.
He's
like a watermelon. He's like a piece of fruit.
The shapes on the parts of his beard that are white and the parts that are black. The shapes of his glasses, the shapes of his clothes, exactly where his waistline is. It's all super calibrated to be just totally perfect. Clever is written in the script as clever.
Clever.
With two V's and an A at the end.
And you can hear Melamed roll it a little bit because the way it was written. Did Larry's guiding light guide him towards truth?
No, I don't think so.
No, Ray's shaking his head and I agree.
Whatever this line that he's straddling between like having the answers and not having the answers is like, I mean, it seems awful.
He didn't do anything.
This film doesn't, I think one of the things that's ultimately kind of like the most devastating is this film doesn't really offer like a way out. It kind of presents a bunch of like different pathways between the Mentaculous, the stuff that Danny's learning the shul and the stuff that Larry's teaching, the physics stuff that he's teaching at school, is all just kind of being ultimately pretty funky to tie your fate to.
I think his neighbor is like the closest thing
to a happy person.
Yeah, or like someone who's kind of had a, kind of found a way out.
Oh, you're talking about the
Mrs. Samsky.
Mrs. Samsky, she's cool.
Yeah, played by Amy Landecker.
Yeah, maybe make a short where you take Mrs. Samsky and put her in a parallel dimension.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
Mrs. Samsky goes to the cinema in downtown Minneapolis.
Right.
In 1967.
Or just the Regal in Battery Park.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Pasta dinner. Go to Shake Shack. Okay, I just did want to say one thing, which is like, I just really wish that when Arthur says, hey, could you take a look at this? There was a little bit of Larry and Arthur sitting next to each other, and Larry's like giving him notes on the Mentaculous. This is not a criticism of the film. It's just a scene that I would like to see. Just to know more, is like when he looks at the Mentaculous, it's just he's looking at a crazy person. It's like 12 monkeys.
What it really reminds me, the velocity of it reminds me most of the scenes from Crumb, the Terry Zwigoff friend of the Coens.
Yeah.
Crumb documentary where his brother gets really into drawing things with a certain kind of squiggly lines as a kind of like motif.
Yeah.
And then over time you keep going through the pages
and then it just
and the characters are just devolving into just pure
squiggles until it's just
or like, it's like yeah, it's like he's doing concentric lines basically so that their arms start to become like where their arms go from having like five lines to kind of like segment them to just like it looks like the wacko William H. Macy doodle that he was just doing on set where it's just this maniacal energy and you can just see the person just doesn't want to leave that spot where they're drawing.
Definitely. The relationship between Larry and Arthur is very much like the relationship between Crumb and his brother. Yeah, because they have similar impulses and they have similar like desires to put pen to paper, but one of them just kind of made it work for him.
Yeah, one can kind of have a foot in society and a foot in the totally abstract cosmic world. You know?
He gets to live in Paris and put out funky books. But yeah, no, I would have loved to have seen just like even a little bit of Larry just being like, yeah, you know, if you carry the one.
Well, I can see like what the Crumb thing made me think of is like maybe there was a version of the Mentaculous when they were kids that Larry could look at. And it's like the first time he's looking, because when he says I'm working on the Mentaculous, it kind of made it just seem like, oh, this guy has always been working on the Mentaculous. You know, it's just kind of like a code for I'm in my zone of introspection right now. I'm working on something that no one can see. I'm not sure.
Well, there's an interview with Michael Stuhlbarg, which I believe my brother conducted for his website, where he talks about how the Coens knew somebody who really had something called the Mentaculous. They wrote it into the script because it was a real thing.
Barry, the lead, what's this information?
The Mentaculous is real.
There's a real Mentaculous.
There's a real Mentaculous out there.
And did it help the guy adapt to modern life, or was it like a boundary or was it a barrier to it?
Let's put a pin in that. I'll come back with more info.
So your brother tracked this down. Your brother loves this movie?
My brother interviewed Michael Stuhlbarg.
Okay.
Because he's a writer in Los Angeles, and one of the things he did in his career is interview interesting actors for Venice Magazine. And he interviewed Michael Stuhlbarg, and Michael Stuhlbarg said the Mentaculous is based on a real thing that the Coens, a friend of the Coens, wrote/drew.
And it was called the Mentaculous.
I believe it was called the Mentaculous, yeah.
What is a Mentaculous? It's like a mental homunculus?
I think it's mentally spectaculous.
It's a mental spectaculous?
It's mental spectacle.
Mental spectacle.
Yeah.
But like a syllabus.
Yeah. Like a succubus.
A succubus.
No, homunculus sounds okay. let's wrap it up. Sometimes in life, we look towards art or maps or abstractions to tie things up, summarize a podcast. And sometimes those maps help us. Sometimes they, you know, if they're movies, they can help us, right? Like if Josh Brolin's character decides to go to a movie in World Cinema, the short, or if he decides to keep on making movies as Mannix in Hail Caesar, that's to the good. He's got his eyes on the prize, art, the ambiguity of art. But if your focus is on totally zoning out on some hotel picture or the Mona Lisa that's been, you know, had its meaning flattened by endless reproductions. Or if you think that you have found the meaning of life and it's that you can't know anything because you know math, then maybe you're lost. Maybe your guiding light is it's a false prophet.
Do you think that they're really trying to make a point?
No. I mean,
I always feel like they. Yeah. That's the whole thing to really figuring it out is that anytime you get into like the thesis of this film is this. It's like, it's more kinetic than that. It's more about the experience of moving through it, latching onto something, and then getting lost. Like the moment that you get a feeling of orientation, that's usually when they rip the rug out from under you.
For sure.
Because like who got, like the only person who got what they wanted was Josh Brolin, right? And it was something different than he even expected. But I really think what the difference was is that he just had someone who knew what was going on. Like all the other scenes are someone alone trying to interact with an inanimate object and trying to figure out like what they should do to protect themselves.
Yeah.
Based off of like what this thing that's just like, it's a picture of the beach. It's not the beach.
Yeah.
You know, the map is just like a bunch of symbols that represent the shape of Japan.
Yeah.
But it's very, very abstract, you know?
Like maybe Frances McDormand should have gone along with, in last week's episode, like instead of only having like his Jamba Juice to calm him down, maybe Frances McDormand should have been in the car with Brad Pitt when he went on that sneaky sneak.
Yeah, or like...
Like you just don't want to find yourself so lonely that you're looking to some handkerchief.
Nobody takes as good care of Barton as Hesloff takes care of Brolin.
And maybe when he gets close to it, he can't accept it, right? Like Audrey's pretty nice to him. I think what we're trying to say is you need a Grant Heslov in your life.
Don't you think George Clooney agrees?
Exactly. Exactly. He is the key to all of this. Grant Heslov, he's the key to all of this. That was the segue to Poetry Corner. This is a poem by Ethan Coen called My Father's Briefcase, and I think it's apropos of some of the things we discussed today.
My father's briefcase. His briefcase was a lightish brown. Its leather tongue would buckle down to keep his students' blue book in. At night, he'd grade them with a frown. Each morning, he would pick it up, tongue-tethered thing of brownish hue, and out he'd go in blasts of cold, blew in until the door swung to. He'd walk it to the city bus, the leather briefcase lightish brown. The bus was the first of two. He transferred when he got downtown. He traveled on the city bus, the M18, he caught downtown. He'd spend the day out at the U. His briefcase was a lightish brown. He bore a heavy teaching load, gave counsel during office hours, engaged in research vexed, obscure, that would have mocked a lesser's powers, and got back home with the sky full dark and stew a simmer on the stove. His coat still gripped the grizzled cold with which it two times daily strove. And he removed the coat from him, the leather briefcase lightish brown. A bulge with books afresh to grade would creak as he would set it down. It rested in the entrance hall while he consumed first steaming stew, then hearty draughts of ginger ale, and mighty belches did ensue. The dishes cleared, he picked it up, the leather briefcase lightish brown, and from its swollen belly drew the pamphlets he alone could sound. In kitchen light, he scratches marks in little books whose crackling leaves we warm a bed could hear above the wind that whinnied in the eaves. Lightish brown.
Lightish brown.
It's almost like an intrusive thought.
Lightish brown.
But at the end, it's like, it's mostly like this guy is like a metronome and you can just like fall asleep upstairs knowing that like the wind is outside and this guy's unstoppable.
It's comforting. It's a ritual.
This seems like they had a steady, a kind of like...
A clickety-clack.
They had a clickety-clack dad.
Yeah. Hell yeah. I really love that poem.
It's got a melancholy in it that their movies have. You can feel the like Carter Burwell like emotion coming off of this poem even without the like... the actual melodies and sounds.
Yeah. Should we call it there?
I love it, Jordan.
I love it too. That was To the White Sea, episode 14.
Pages 27 and 28. Come back next week for episode 15.
Pages 29 and 30.
The end of Act 1.
The end of Act 1. Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh.
To the White Sea is produced by Jordan Fish and Ray Tintori.
Starring Griffin Newman as Lieutenant Muldrow.
Production support provided by Ben Hosley and Ike Sreeskandaraja.
To the White Sea theme music written and performed by Dan Romer.